Good morning. Meeting of the Pole and Conduit Commission, Thursday, October 17th. It's 10:02 a.m. We're in the Michael J. Lombardi Building, 831 Mass Ave Conference Room. Before you are the commissioners, Chair Nicole Moratti Ferrer, Steve Kouskas, and TJ Shea.
Okay, good morning. So I just, first of all, thank you to everyone that submitted something. I would love, again, for people to be around the table, as I would want this to be more of a conversation than anything else. So if we can have a Verizon representative at this table, a Crown Castle, AT&T, Extenet, and I think that's, let me see, I feel like someone else submitted something.
From the Harvard Business Association?
Yeah, but they just went in support of, and I know I don't see her here, so. But anyways, if you submitted any type of stuff, if you can sit around the table, that'd be great. So this is sort of where I'm at, and again, my fellow commissioners, I'm sure will have something to say about it. As you may know, this has been a really long process, and it not only involves the three of us, but it also involves council for the city. And as you may or may not know, we cannot meet with the council for the city together, so because it would be a violation of the open meeting law. So I think it has taken a long time. There's a lot of attorneys looking at this. At the same time, I think based on the comments that we got, well, not based on the comments, based on my review of the proposed revised small cell policy, I do have some concerns or some questions that I would like to further clarify with council. I think some of those things were shared by the people that submitted comments to us. I also have clarifying questions for the people that submitted comments, which I'm sort of kind of bummed that not everyone's here, because I was hoping to go through them and ask some specific questions as to them. But in terms of myself, what I am going to propose, aside from after hearing all of you on this, I am not ready to vote on the revised small cell policy, again, because I think some of you raised some really good points. And obviously, I'm not sure that I would want to proceed with a policy that we are going to have to further amend. With that said, all of your comments have been submitted to council, and they are being reviewed. I have not received input on all of them. So what I'm going to propose, and I'm just going to throw it out from way from the beginning, it doesn't mean that it's going to happen, but this is what's going to be my proposal for the commission, is that we go through this, that we hear your thoughts today as well, if you want to say anything else or after our questions or whatever, and I would put a pin on this. I would put it back on the agenda for the 31st, hoping that before then we post something with revisions as discussed today, or as we discussed with our council after the fact, after hearing all of you and after taking all of this in. And then from there, we hear any new small cell stuff with hopefully the new policy or the updated policy as adopted on the 31st, and then hear those petitions on the November agenda. But we can clarify that more as we go along. Yeah.
Question, because I'm a little confused in taking notes here. When you're talking about you cannot meet with counsel, I originally wrote COUNCIL. You're talking the solicitor.
The three of us, yes.
Okay, you're talking
the three of us together.
You're talking COUNSEL. COUNSEL.
The city solicitor.
City
solicitor.
Okay, yeah.
Not the city
council. I was confused, and then something you said later made me think.
No.
I was confused. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. But anyways, with that said, and for you, those of you that came in, is there anyone here from Verizon?
I'm here from Verizon.
If you can please take a seat at the table. I know you don't want to sit here, but I promise you, we don't bite. Your name, please?
Paula Foley.
And Paula, I'm sure you've seen Stan's letter?
Yes.
Okay. So question if you have it in front of you. So he mentions the issue about the annual fee.
Mm-hmm.
So is he saying that the 270 annual fee is not, is he basically saying that it's against FCC regulation? Is that his position on this?
No, it's not. What he is saying is that the $270 annual fee is characterized in your proposed policy as a recertification and public way fee. And it's the characterization of it as a public way fee that Verizon has a problem with. You don't feel that there's state law in place that allows municipalities to charge a public way fee unless it's cost-based. There is authorization from the FCC to charge a $270 fee because that's a presumptively reasonable amount.
Yep.
But it under state law, if you apply state law and federal law together, you cannot call it a public way fee.
Okay.
But you can impose a fee.
So, okay.
So would that differentiate between a utility pole and a city-owned pole? I mean, would it be a separate fee for each?
So under our current and the revised policy, the 270 is the same.
Across the board.
And per small cell application. The reason I was confused is because that fee comes directly from the FCC, but I understand now what you're saying is that calling it that public way fee
There's no separate authorization to impose a fee called a public way fee under state law.
Okay. Got it. And also, I think a lot of you raised the same type of issues. I am literally going in the order that I received these comments. That's why I started with Verizon. So if I jump into something that you mentioned as well, if you just want to pop in and say something as well, that you can do that as well, just as an FYI. The waiver provision, I totally agree. I think that's something that we should look at, and that's just my sense, and that's something that I don't know how you two feel about that.
No, I agree with that. There needs to be a little more flexibility in certain situations.
I can foresee what council attorneys will say on this, which is basically that obviously we don't want to give free rein to the extent that we are doing this in a discriminatory manner, but I'm sure we can come up with a way on how to phrase that. But I agree that this is a provision that we should certainly look at. Okay, technical review and approval requirements. So a lot of you sort of raised this issue, and I guess my question to you all is it your position that the commission under current FCC regulation and current law does not allow the commission to ask why a particular small cell installation is needed? And we can start with you and then just go around.
Well, I think you can ask why, but I don't think you can deny a petition based on your disappointment with whatever the response would be.
If I can throw some color on there, I think part of the issue is that, especially when we're talking about small cells, we're talking about the difference between coverage and capacity. Cambridge has great coverage everywhere, right? It's a pretty relatively small jurisdiction with a bunch of towers and a bunch of small cells already deployed. So you're always going to have four bars on your phone. You might not be able to place a call. And the reason is because all of the availability, all of the coverage on that small cell is already absorbed. So we could be providing you, hypothetically, were we to be providing coverage maps, it wouldn't look all that different with the addition of a small cell because coverage is great. So that's kind of the issue, is that when we're talking about coverage and capacity, it's really hard to show something that demonstrates the need the way that you might want it to look.
Okay. Mr. Rashes, do you have
anything? I think also that the FCC would fairly clear that the gap in coverage standard no longer applies, and that's very important. The new standard is, the need is based upon what the carrier or the party building it thinks is the need. And there may be reasons beyond anything the city could think of in terms of or justify, such as gap in coverage is gone, capacity to some extent is gone. it may just purely be that there's a node needed at that spot because we anticipate taking down another node in a year and we don't want to tell anyone we're taking it down. There could be a whole variety of reasons that really the old standards, which were different in each circuit, really infringed upon the carriers and the constructors, such as Extenet's, confidential data as well. And that was a big part of it.
Okay. I'm sorry, sir, are you from any company in particular?
Yeah, we're for AT&T.
Ah, perfect. Please take a seat.
I'm not going to participate, though. That's okay.
Oh.
Yeah.
But I have questions on the letter you guys submitted.
I'd be happy to talk with you about them, but I'm not going to participate.
So okay. And way in the back?
I'm with the city in the Historical Commission.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. Okay. So, and I know that a lot of you mentioned this in your letters, but I guess my question is, one of the proposals is to have a licensed professional say that this is needed. But I know that some of you also questioned whether that would be appropriate. And I guess my question is exactly, I mean, why? I mean, you guys have to express a reason why you want this, other than to avoid the company next to me from getting the spot, correct? Or are you saying that this could really be your reason, and under FCC regulation, we can't say no?
I think the city has that particular reason, I think, is somewhat invalid when you realize the cost of these. It's not going to be. You don't run into competition where someone's willing to invest that much money just to, on that corner, have someone out. Across the board, that would be an interesting approach, but I don't think it's going to work on that basis because you can't get every single street corner. I look at areas where we are built. Boston is one of them. The worst right now is New York City, where New York City is, to be honest with you and off the record, they are praying for the T-Mobile Sprint merger to go through because they allow one on each corner. They don't allow mid-blocks. And all four corners, occasionally there's one of the four corners at an intersection that has something else on it, and you can't put up a small cell. And there are battles for the other three there because the construction, especially in Manhattan with the buildings, you don't get as wide coverage as you would. Let's say here we're built, what's the top building in the town is 10, 15 stories in the city of Cambridge? I don't know.
No, they're growing.
Growing, but I mean, you don't have an average of 50 stories every corner. No. So in that case, I wouldn't say it's trying to block others, but it's certainly every corner is getting filled up. Here, there's not that, it's the ability to go a block away and still have the coverage is physically possible here, which makes it that is not going to be happening. I think the rationale for building in many cases is very proprietary. They hold, even Extenet, where we're building on behalf of someone, sometimes we don't know the exact reason they're going in that location. It's Crown, you're with Crown, right?
Yep.
I think you're in the same boat.
We are.
I mean, they just tell us, no, that's where we want to go. Well, why? We don't want to tell you that. I mean, we find that a lot, and we build on that basis. In addition, it's important to note, not to throw the two carriers that are here, but from Extenet and Crown's position, please correct me if I'm speaking on your behalf and I'm wrong, we're neutral host providers. Our business model is based on building a site and then getting others to use that site in addition to the primary or the initial contractee. So in those cases where we choose, where basically we never, at least Extenet, we don't build on spec. We only build once we have a contract to build in that location. Once we have that location up, we're trying to get, if it's a Verizon location, we're begging AT&T to come sign the contract to come on there. We're begging T-Mobile, and we try to build for capacity for three, which three is really not going to the extent of the FCC's maximum cabinet size or anything. Three is a aesthetically acceptable, aesthetically pleasing size that we can get stuff in. So in that respect, we're certainly not trying to block others. We're encouraging them to come to that location.
And to that point, the coverage justification is irrelevant. The reason it's the best location is because there's already a site at that location, right? The map wouldn't be irrelevant because the alternative would be we're going to build in the next closest pole, which is obviously not what the policy is intended to do. Hmm.
So what would stop you from having a common project? So for instance, you have a shroud or equipment that can handle up to four customers. As we do with underground conduit, when we have a common trench, all the participants will share in the cost and the space for that whole system. What would stop you from calling your project, for instance, a common project for small cells and being able to put four companies on within? You would be the lead, of course, with your shroud, and you would charge or share the burden of the cost with maybe ExteNet, maybe AT&T. I know they are customers now, but I mean, if you could go to that business model to have a common project.
I think what's incredible, I'm going to say a few words and then I'll pass it off, but I think that when you're talking about digging the street, right, the person who is actually installing the fiber, or the mostly fiber, still owns that asset that's in the street. In this case, the asset that ExteNet or Crown owns is the shroud and the antenna, and it gets far more complicated, I think, on that front to kind of have a profit sharing.
Yeah, I could see it's very complicated, but we do the same thing with manholes. I mean, the common trenches, they share the manholes. That's
I'm not sure the model exists anywhere.
Yeah.
Well,
not that it can't. I mean,
what we're doing is we need the initial build. Mm-hmm. Let's hypothetically say that's AT&T is our initial customer. We build to them. It's violations of various antitrust laws for AT&T to turn to Verizon and say, join us in this project. They can't do that under various antitrust laws right now. Once we're up and running, we then, as due course, because we own our nodes, we own our equipment, we then, our salespeople, will go out. Say we build under contract for AT&T. Part of those contracts says we're a neutral host provider. We can install other radios. We always have to give AT&T or the first build, let's just call it the first builder, right of first refusal. So if they say, well, capacity-wise, we need a second radio in there, we don't want to, there's no, and that's only sized for two radios, they can get priority. But if there is the capacity to add another radio, and the antennas usually have capacity for up to three radios, actually, 5G even more than that, our sales folk are constantly trying to market out existing sites to other carriers. And we would come in under, I can't remember the name of the bill, we would then be coming into the commission under the, for lack of better words, the Obama Jobs Act. I can't remember the site to it. It's like 6409. For a modification to the site. So it's a completely different process. But in those cases, we are encouraging that. But it's after the build. It's very difficult to do that before the build.
But the build that you would be proposing is a build that will service a particular company, and then after you look for other companies to join in.
Right.
Okay. So I guess our thing is, okay, fine, but why not do that right off the bat? Is that where you're getting at in terms of...
Well, is it an antitrust thing?
It's partially antitrust. It's also partially just economics. In many cases, and there is someone from AT&T in the room. I'm sorry that I keep blaming them as the first. In many cases, AT&T decides where they're going in Cambridge. And the other three carriers, at that moment, have different plans in Cambridge or don't have plans for that particular corner. A year from now, they are constantly, they're as time stretches on, each of the carriers is constantly reevaluating where they need new resources and facilities and where they're pouring money. So you may actually, right now, we have before the commission AT&T builds and T-Mobile builds. They're in different locations. None of them are across the street from each other or down the block from each other. 6 months from now, a year from now, once we get, let's say, the AT&T builds up, T-Mobile, Verizon, Sprint may come to us and say, we want to build on that corner, you know, the corner, you know, on right in front of 831 Massachusetts Avenue. We want to build at 832 Massachusetts Avenue across the street. And we will then come to, we will then go to them when they're coming out to bid for that and say, look, and this is just excess practice, look, it's going to be a lot faster to deploy on our existing node across the street at 831. Let's go there. And 99% of the time, unless they have an absolute crazy reason, and there are such reasons, they will say, yes, okay, let's do that. And some of those crazy reasons may be, just so you know, they may have a huge customer in a building across the street where the node literally across the street from that building as opposed to in front of that building may not reach everyone in the back of that building because of the construction of the building, especially 5G, which has more trouble penetrating through certain types of architectural structures.
So, I think that you know, my colleagues from Verizon can speak to this, but the RF designs are changing on a weekly, daily, monthly basis very, very frequently. What they need today is different than what they'll need a year from today. And because of that, the concept of a common project where, you know, generally speaking, the hope is that you would be digging the same street within the next 2 months or something like that, you know, we don't necessarily know what that coverage need is 3 months from now.
And let me add, the carriers don't even.
Certainly. It's changing all the time, and it's changing based on development in the neighborhood. It's changing based on, you know, the need for that common project in the beginning. And I don't know that there would be a way to predict appropriately what is going to be needed 6 or 8 or 10 months from now.
And you also have external factors. For example, within the city, and I'm making a broad-based assumption on this, but I think it's 99% true, probably the two biggest employers are MIT and Harvard. And I don't know who they have their cell phone contract with. I have seen in certain cities where a university changes their cell phone contract, so all their employees are on a different carrier, and all of a sudden that carrier is overwhelmed with having to build in that city because, you know, if every Harvard faculty and employee who has a Harvard-owned phone switches hypothetically from AT&T to Verizon, Verizon's going to have a much larger need in the city than they did before that contract was signed. So you could have also things like that, external things.
Okay. All right. Brings me, let me see the next issue here. Oh, the antenna equipment and dimensions of the pole height. I think everyone raised an issue on this, and I think...
I can agree that there needs to be more clarification, especially on wood utility poles, because they can vary in size anywhere from 35 to 40, 45 feet. So I think that needs to be looked at a little closer. The city-owned poles, you'll find that they are typically, the highest pole is 30 feet, so a percentage of height beyond that, as in the proposed, I think it's 10%. You know, that gives you roughly a three-foot extension on top of an existing 30-foot pole.
The way the policy is written, it's whichever is less, 30 feet or 10%.
And that's something that should be looked at. Yeah. Because if it was less, then you couldn't put anything on top of all the poles we have out there.
And I think just from a definitions perspective, are we talking about overall height means the height of the luminaire or the height of the top of the antenna?
Well, the luminaire is different from, you know, you got the luminaire, you got the pole, then you're going to have the antenna.
Yeah.
So I think we need to clarify what's
good.
What.
That's good.
And in addition, if I can use the board just for a real crude drawing here. When you're talking the additional height, let's say you have a double acorn. And you want us to, we want to install an antenna there. The logical place of the antenna is actually probably right here, and that the typical antenna is usually about 4 to 5 feet, which would be taller than thing. And in terms of the other option, which I don't think is preferable to the city, and if I'm looking at it from the side view, at least I don't think aesthetically it's, you know, if this is the side view, is to put a T-arm and then the antenna. And I think that looks more in character with the double acorns that are out there right now, is having it mounted above.
I think in one of the illustrations, it does call out a 45-inch extension and then the antenna with a certain height.
Right.
So that would reflect.
That would be the T-arm.
Bringing that above the luminaire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Other than, I mean, I know that Crown Castle, you made a recommendation in terms of using the volumetric volumetric restrictions and the shroud size that the FCC applies.
Well, and I think that's an alternative to but my true preference is that we deploy a co-locatable shroud and antenna on the anchor build. And the reason I think that's the better option.
I'm sorry, run that by me again.
we put up a bigger shroud and a bigger antenna from the beginning.
Okay,
and when we put up the bigger shroud and the bigger antenna from the beginning, that encourages co-location the way that you guys are trying to make it happen.
Right.
What it does in the alternative is if we put up the smaller shroud, then it's just going to create confusion about what might ultimately be there. Because the smaller shroud in the first instance is not co-locatable, what's been proposed right now.
And I think Verizon has actually a very simple position on this, as demonstrated in the comments. Verizon feels that any dimensional limitations are not appropriate. The FCC has established what a small wireless facility is, and that's what the Cambridge should follow.
Okay, great. Thank you. Anything else? Anyone else on
so
that
just,
one?
Just So that is that your opinion for both the utility-owned pole and a city-owned pole?
Yes, that the FCC definition should apply.
And that's in volumetric also, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Okay. License agreement, yes. Yes and yes.
Okay, good.
Good. And yes. So, as an FYI, I have been pushing to see it. I have not gotten it. It was not ready as of 9:59 a.m. today for it to be distributed. Again, as I said in the beginning, the intent is for it to be posted along with the agenda of the 31st and any changes that we make based on what we have received and what we talk about today and what we talk about with potentially our legal counsel, for it to be reviewed and seen, although I'm not quite sure how much these license agreements will be edited in terms of comments received, because it literally is the city's agreement, but yes, you need to be able to see it. Yes, I agree. And I know that the intent is to write it in such a way that it is compliant with the FCC regulations and anything that the city can or cannot request, but I don't have it.
Okay.
But I agree, yes, you need it.
Yes, and the rules appear to imply that there are two separate agreements, one for utility poles and one for city poles, is that right? That have different language?
Yes, and that needs clarification as well, because again, based on my review and what I have sort of discussed and talked about and learned, is that this would be the license agreement with the city only. It wouldn't be the license agreement that, for example, that you guys would use with NSTAR to get under pole or anything like that. Based on my understanding, again, I agree that that needs clarification in our policy, because that's how I read it. I'm not sure how you guys read it. I don't know that we can demand that you enter into an agreement that we create for someone else's poll.
I agree.
Yes, I agree that it doesn't read as carefully. I know that the first version of the policy that was adopted, for me, reads like it's the same agreement. I thought it was clarified on the second one, but it's certainly something that needs to be clarified. I don't know that it would be for both.
Okay.
I just want to clarify, I'm not sure how the policy reads on this. Once that agreement is signed, it covers all future applications as well? No, is it going to be a site-specific agreement, or is it going to be a general license agreement for the city pending what's approved by the Pole and Condo Commission? In other words,
it was site-specific.
So again, I haven't seen it, but I believe it's site-specific. Yeah. Site-specific for that particular installation. So, for example, if you were to go on a city-owned pole, it's the same as when you go on, like, a utility-owned pole. You need a license agreement for that pole.
One suggestion, which the utility which would be to have that license agreement, a general license agreement with an amendable appendix. So every time you add a pole, only appendix A has to be revised to list all the poles that Extenet is authorized to be on. From our standpoint, it's a lot less paperwork.
What is done now? I mean, you have to be licensed now to be on a utility pole.
So we have our license agreement that covers generically all of the Eversource, jointly owned Eversource Verizon poles, and then we get a pole-by-pole attachment agreement. I think that another aside, one alternative would be amending an Exhibit X or whatever. An alternative would be that we have a generic agreement that covers our relationship with the city with respect to pole attachments, and then the specific node-by-node attachment agreement is the granted location that Pole and Conduit Commission provides, which is how it, I think, more consistent with how it works in other jurisdictions around Greater Boston.
Except I think in here we don't own, like we don't, it has to be with the city. I think that's the city's position, that the city has to provide the permission to use the pole. It's kind of like when you are having an event on the public sidewalk. I can't license that as for alcohol license unless DPW gives you permission to use that sidewalk.
Which raises another issue, which is the shot clock and the FCC's third report and order anticipates that once we file, all approvals from the city will be within the shot clock deadline.
I know that you raised that, and like I said, I'm going
okay.
But now that you brought it up, I think my question on that is, based on the way that the policy is, the revised policy, when I'm talking about policy, I mean the revised one, sorry, the revised policy is written, in theory, that legwork, because it's already identifying everything you need, and you know that this pole is owned by the city, that legwork, meaning getting that license agreement signed, and all of that is happening prior to you filing the application. So when you file the application, you have all of that. Because, hold on, I think the powers that be that have been working on this, their mentality is that, for example, the license agreement, which hopefully will be ready and everyone will see, this is something, it's like a standard, it's not something that requires other than, let's say, a signature and it being forwarded all together, the same way as when you file an application, you have your engineers or whoever do your pictures and your very beautiful diagrams and whatever, and you have all of that together.
That's not the way the FCC order reads, just so you know.
It might not be the way that it reads, but we're trying to streamline the process. I mean, certainly, if you file an application, or this is my sense of it, if you file an application and you're going on a city-owned pole and you haven't yet submitted your request to whoever has to sign the city agreement, we have to either deem it incomplete because you don't have your license agreement, and then now it gets stopped, or we reject it at the time it's here because you haven't complied with the policy. So what's the point of going through and spinning the wheels when you've already been identified? These are the 10, I'm just saying, these are the 10 items that you need to submit a complete application. This is the process how you get these 10 items. I know this was also raised with historical things. You know, these are things that can happen. I mean, if you already know you're like in Harvard Square, it's a historic district. Why are you going to wait for us to tell you that it's a historic district when you already know that? Why not immediately go to historical and say, this is what we're doing, get your thing and submit it all together?
So I think that I understand your point. I think what you're suggesting is that really the node-by-node license agreement that's necessary to submit the application is highly administrative, that there shouldn't be too much discretion at the outset.
That's my again, I have not seen
well,
it.
Well, if it does, then I think it would. If there's any discretion at the first instance, then I think there's no question that the shot clock starts on asking for the application, you know, node-by-node application. And I think the reason is because how many levels of discretionary review do we have to go through, and mm-hmm. who has the final say? I think that's a reason why that license agreement should govern our, you know, understood that Pole and Conduit doesn't have authority to lease or whatever we want to call it, a streetlight, but we should have one agreement like we do with the utility that governs our relationship to attach to any street light of the city, because there is one body somewhere that has the authority to sign off on that. And if they're the ones that are providing discretionary approval, then we need to rethink how the 90 days are going to work.
Okay.
I'm trying to find the exact language in the order. It's pretty clear.
All right. Location. We'll, I'll get it back because, Haran, I think you identified it on your thing. So you're third online. We'll get there.
All right.
We'll revisit again. Location and siting standards. The 15 feet. I think this is something that we have raised in the past. Also, it's something that needs to be looked at because most of our stuff isn't 15 feet. So I agree. I was under the impression that it was revised, although it might have not been revised as clearly as possible.
I think that's more of a clarification for a new installation, because of course we have poles within the 15 feet. If there's an existing pole within 15 feet and they want to attach to it or modify it, I don't see anything. I don't know that that would be an issue.
Yeah.
But if they want to go in that location and there is not a pole there, it should not be within 15 feet of the corner. I think that was the
corner or the curb.
I read it. I got confused on the exact same thing. It seemed like they were assuming a 15-foot sidewalk.
It says, shall be placed at least 15 feet from the edge of the curb of the public right-of-way, unless the applicant proves substantial evidence that the restriction will constitute an effective prohibition. And it says, no installation shall be placed less than 6 feet away from the edge of a driveway or of a residential or commercial property.
If by edge of the curb, was that meant to say intersection? Because I think that was highly confusing.
Yeah, I think we need clarification.
Yeah,
I took it as a corner, so you're not cluttering a corner, so you keep it for sight lines and visibility, that you would not want to put an additional pole if within 15 feet. But if there is an existing street light there that you may want to attach to, that should be dealt differently than a brand new pole that you want to put there.
And I read curb as literally the edge of the street.
Curb line.
The cement lip to the grass.
Yeah. I did too, and I figured we have none of these
so we'll
that comply.
I didn't even look at it that way.
I can't be present. I think I'd have no problem. Just as we have no problem with 6 feet from a driveway, I don't think we'd have a problem with 15 feet from the corner for a new pole.
Exactly.
For a new pole.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. Yeah. I think a lot of these dimensions needs to be clarified as far as does it apply to a wood pole? Does it apply to an existing city-owned pole? Or does it apply to a new installation from ground up?
Okay. Anyone else? Because I know that this came up, I think, with everyone. Okay. Do you want to say something?
No. Sorry.
All right. And then the last thing that Verizon, procedural requirements. I agree with regard to as you all know from our siting policy and also from, you know, the first policy or the current policy of the small cell and the revised policy, we're really pushing for co-location. I think that's super clear. I think the intent is very clear on that. I agree that procedurally, I am not fond of the certified mail prior to and then after. I find it very cumbersome. Again, a lot of people have been working on this, so I don't know the theory behind it, but I hear you all on this issue. I do have, and again, I'm running out of working space here, but I know that someone mentioned something to the effect of the 3 days, and the 3 days being too much or whatever. But so there's two two notices here. The first notice is to other companies, other potential wireless companies, and I hear, and I think it was Haran that mentioned it specifically, or maybe it was AT&T, I can't remember, but one of you mentioned the fact that doing it prior to filing your application can be really cumbersome in terms of what you are doing and your business model and competition-wise and all of that stuff. But I think at the same time, our intent is the same way as we ask people to send common trench letters. And I think that was the original intent of having notification to other wireless so that we promote this co-location. But I'm wondering if, as with the common trench letter, we're not requesting these to be, we just put the onus on the applicant, you have to do, quote unquote, instead of a common trench, a common installation letter. I'm not sure. So I guess my first question is to you guys and whether you know the intent behind that.
Well, usually we'll get the petition in a haunted dig, and we will not request that until we hear the petition. It's usually not done beforehand.
True.
For the common
trench.
That's
how it's been, yeah, in our siting policy for conduit installation.
But we have asked for regular, and I'm sorry for sort of diverting here, we have asked in the past, let's say Verizon comes up and we say, have you sent out a common trench letter? And sometimes they have prior to the meeting because
but
they know.
But we don't require them to. We have not required them to.
But they have done so based on their experience that we would request it at some point after the fact. Problem here with small cells is what has been mentioned a couple of times and what's been peppered throughout this is the shot clocks that the FCC regulation does.
Right.
So, for example, we can't really, let's say that they come up with a small cell application and then we say, well, wait a minute, have you notified other providers? And at that point, the 10 days have passed, we have said that their application is complete. In theory, if we accept some of the arguments that have been made to us by the companies, we can't ask them at that point to then do something extra for the application. So, if our intent is for them to explore whether co-location can happen right off the bat, then I think, and again, based if legal counsel looks at this and says it's fine, I think saying that they have to sort of put it out there, and I'm not sure in what way, we're applying for X location, we're looking to see if any company wants to co-locate, and whether that's done as an advertisement or a letter to the companies or whatever, a tweet or whatever, that happens before the fact. But I agree that in terms of certified mail, return receipt, and then after they get the hearing, the certified mail, return receipt, that is too much.
Let me throw something out there. I think it would suffice the antitrust rules and what the commission is attempting to do, which would be upon filing, you must affirmatively state that you have contacted all existing or apply for sites within 500 feet of your site.
What do you mean applied for sites?
In other words, if Exxon has applied for a site on some corner and Crown comes in and wants something within 500 feet, and they know that they know because we have filed that Exxon's application is pending, then they have to contact us. That's what I mean by...
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
Pending rental locations.
Yeah.
The ones that are currently...
Pending construction. I mean...
I also think that...
That's all public information.
I also think that, quite frankly, the affidavit where we're asking them to certify a whole bunch of things, or even in the application we can ask a question is, have you contacted other companies? For me, I think that would be sufficient. I think if someone then says, like, for example, if Exxon says, yes, we did that, and then Crown Castle comes up and says, we never got anything from them, then it's on Exynet for them to prove that they did send something to Crown Castle. I don't particularly need the certified mails, the return receipt, the green cards, the return, the receipt from the post office. I don't need all of that. I think we can handle it the same way that we handle our other grant of locations, which is they have to do it and they have to keep proof that they did that for 2 years. How they do it is on them.
One thing I think could help in this area is to make it clear what you want us to do with the information once we hear it. And I think that's, you know, if I get a letter from Exonet that says we're going to build on, you know, Broadway, it might not mean anything to me for 6, 8, 10 months, and I'll have forgotten that I got the notice. I'm not sure what other jurisdictions have stuff that's similar to this, and there's language around you have an immediate intent to build in the same location or something like that. And in other jurisdictions, the intent is to prevent two people from applying for one pole. And there could be some clarity around what the goal is, because I don't need more mail from these guys.
No, like I said, I mean, the way that I read it, I think the intent was to ensure that you guys are working together to do co-location so that we don't have on every other pole, like, you know, the five different companies that exist on the same stretch because you guys didn't co-locate and you were all around. I thought that was the original intent of...
I believe, as you mentioned, with New York, you know, the fight for four corners, and you have six people if you were to co-locate.
But yeah, so we'll look at that. But I think that's the general intent. The general intent is that you guys do this right off the bat and not after. And unfortunately, I think it has to be done pre-application or simultaneously with the application because of the shot clocks. If we weren't tied to the FCC shot clocks, and I can tell you that because this is one of my things. I was like, why is this happening before? You're driving me crazy. Like, why do I have to review all these things? And it's the shot clocks.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I think going for anyone who's already built or who has filed an application at, in ceremony by pending, you're sufficing all of the antitrust law because we're not colluding to build a site together, stuff like that. And it's a known entity. We're not just sending out this willy-nilly, hey, we may be building on this site, what about you? It's a known, in other words, you're sending it out to someone who you know is already intending to build there or has already built there.
But how exactly, so for example, let's take our current system. So you file your applications online. We know about them, but in theory, the public doesn't know about them until they're on an agenda. So let's say that you filed today for the poll right in front of 831 Mass Ave, and Crown Castle files tomorrow. Crown Castle will not know that you filed for that one unless I post it on the agenda.
Would it be difficult to have somewhere on the computer a list of pending applications?
Yes. Yes, it would. And right now, I don't think our system supports that. And that's the thing. So, you know, we'll definitely look at this more, but I think you guys, I hear what you are all saying. I don't disagree that the certified mail return receipt might be a little much, but I think I'm not quite sure exactly how to get around the shot clock and at the same time get to what we're trying to get without asking you to do something when you file. I mean, it might very well be... I mean, I know that someone, I can't remember who it was, but someone mentioned something about a newspaper ad. No one, I mean, very few people read the newspaper nowadays, unfortunately. But I guess if all of you know that something might be published on a regular newspaper, maybe you'll identify someone in your company to scour through the public notices. Not sure. But we'll definitely look at that.
May I just raise one other challenge, and this is consistent with what I was saying earlier about how the RF propagation designs change on a monthly basis, and the fact that Exonet or Verizon is building something today, I may not have something that I need there today, but I may have something that I need there 2 or 3 months from now, and I think that that's another component of why we should make this piece of the application as least onerous as possible.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and I think it's the same as, and I'm not sure if we, I don't disagree which is also the reason why I don't disagree with the fact that when we were requiring that you show us what you're going to build today and what you're going to build 6 months down the line makes no sense at that point, because quite frankly you usually don't know, and if you already know, you're already filing for it. So yes, I don't disagree with that. I think someone mentioned in terms of the 3 days for the abutters about receiving certified mail. It was, and I think it's pretty clear, it's not that you have to send it to the abutter via certified mail and get your proof back within 3 days. It's that if I tell you that your hearing is next, you know, December 12th, today, you have 3 business days from today to send that out, or 3 days, I can't remember how it's written, to send that out to abutters. It's not that you have to, within 3 days, send a certified mail and get your proof back within 3 days.
Well, I think there's another component of the abutter notification that's highly problematic, and that is if the way I read it is that if you don't get your green card back, then you got to send a constable out to provide notification.
I saw that some of you raised that. I did not read it that way, but we'll certainly make that clarification. I think they were giving you you were getting options on how to do it. But I saw that more than one of you raised that issue,
yeah.
And I was like,
We read it the same way.
Okay. No, I would not be okay with that. I'm not sure. I don't know. That's not reasonable at all.
No.
And then the only other thing about certified mail. Certified mail obviously is probably the gold standard in terms of proving receipt. It's also the hardest one to actually deliver. I think there are alternatives. In other jurisdictions, we use a certificate of mail where...
I wanted to ask you that. What is a certificate of mail?
You put first-class mail, regular envelope. You go to the post office, and the post office guarantees that they receive mail from the 10 people or 20 people that you have on the list. It's just a list that they stamp and proves that you did it. And it almost guarantees delivery consistent with any other first-class mail. Certified mail frequently is undeliverable because people don't want to answer their door and sign something, which is not... horribly unreasonable sometimes.
Okay, so basically you go with your abutter list to the post office, they look at it, and they say all of these addresses are valid.
Yes.
And then you would file an affidavit saying, I sent a letter to all of these letters. I mean, I sent a letter to all of these addresses. Or are you saying that the certificate of mail says not only are these valid, but you sent letters to all of these
today? It's not saying it's valid. It's saying that mail was sent to this list.
Okay. But they're not,
even simpler is an affidavit of mail.
I agree.
That is what, in terms of, in courts, when we serve someone, that is generally an existing party. That is generally what is provided. Usually it's the secretary to the attorney will put up an affidavit, have it notarized. On this date, I served mail of such and such.
I don't disagree with that. However, the problem here, and I think the reason why we requested the same way as we requested with any other grant of location, is that when we get questioned by resident A saying, I never got notice of this, we can contact you and say, hey, resident A is saying they did not get notice, and you can be like, right here. And we can be like, all set. But if it's just an affidavit, I mean, not that I don't trust any of you, but it's not sufficient.
The problem is, and this is a true story because it happened to me, it was last Tuesday. I got back a green card, refused delivery, for a certified mail, actually right near here in Revere, that I mailed on May 23rd.
It came back last Wednesday.
Wow.
I don't disagree with you that certified mail, especially returned certified mail, takes a long time, which is why I wanted to ask Joe about the certificate of mail, because I actually had never encountered that. But again, yeah,
It's tough, but it's easier than certified mail.
Yeah, we'll definitely look into it. Yes?
I'll just say the Historical Commission, we send out abutters notices to all abutting properties that are going to be on a future agenda. And then if the mail comes back, we address it to the current resident, and if it comes back again, it kind of covers our backs. So that way we have a record in our office of who received letters and who didn't. I don't know if it's onerous on the Poll and Conduit Commission and staff, but that's how it works for us.
Yeah, someone mentioned that the city do it. That's definitely not happening.
Okay.
We do not have the staff to do this. The abutter notifications on these are, like, ridiculously long.
Sure.
No.
Okay.
but thank you. You are not the only one to suggest it, but I can tell you right now that we just don't have the staff or the capacity to do it.
I think suggestion was not that the city do it, but rather that whoever's doing it be required to do this two-step process that comes back, send it to current resident.
That was one of the other persons, but no, someone also did mention the city do it.
But that's not, doesn't have the problem you identified.
Yes, no.
And it also is important that if you get into an area where there's one or two large condo buildings, an abutter notification, we had one abutter notification, I can't remember what city it was, literally one pole, and they only had abutters within, I think it was 250 feet, or abutting addresses, and it worked out to 3,500 letters that we had to send out.
So thank you for
one pole.
Thank you for bringing that up. I think that would be something that we can discuss. My stance on condo associations or condominiums is that if the applicant provides notice to the condo association and that notice specifically tells the condo association to notify all of its residents and owners, that would suffice. That would be something that I would be happy to adopt a case like this. But, you know, and again, we have to talk to legal counsel about that, but I think that that would suffice.
Madam Chair,
that would be...
There are a lot of small condos. I would suggest you consider putting a number on that, like only condo associations greater than 20 residents or some number like that.
Okay, thank you.
10.
But I don't know what...
Makes sense.
Okay.
The small ones often don't have their act together.
Okay. And then the last thing that you raised on the procedural requirements, and again, I don't think Verizon was the only one that raised this, was deeming an application withdrawn regardless of whether the applicant intends to withdraw it if an application remains incomplete 30 days after the notice. I don't disagree. A lot of people have been working on this. I think it was probably the intent was to sort of make sure that decisions don't have to be written on every single thing that gets put on hold, because I know that a lot of times applications are put in place and they're just left there forever and ever. So quite frankly, if legal counsel deems that this is fine, I would assume that it would stay as is. If not, I think it would be something that it would just be put before the commission for denial at that point for not completing, provided that the shot clock stuff has expired. But we will definitely look into that as well.
Another option, which is not in our comments, would be if it remains complete, 30 days is too short, maybe the 45 or 60, and that time period is extendable with notice. So in other words,
well, it's extendable if you file a tolling agreement, which I think is further down the policy.
If it's deemed incomplete, according to the FCC, it's automatically tolled, so no tolling agreement would be required. Therefore, you know, in other words, it will be deemed incomplete within 45 days unless the applicant notifies the commission that it wishes an additional 45 days. And this can go on indefinitely, but at least you guys know that they're still working on this. That's just sitting out there. In other words, not abandoned or sitting out there. Because in many cases, the information that you need on the incomplete, especially if it comes down to the fiber issues, may require re-engineering, may require coordination, may require entering into contracts with other fiber providers, that it's just, you know, indefinite or very time consuming. Right now, especially right now with the DC Circuit decision in Gatanawa, in rural areas where we have to do NEPA studies, we're talking minimally 3 months to get one done.
Okay, all right. Moving on to XNET. The moratorium issue. I know it doesn't go specifically to the policy, but I just want to mention that person. There was a very specific reason why at that meeting we voted and asked for people. No, we didn't skip Crown Castle, but everything that Crown Castle raised is raised by Verizon, and I think Joe has talked about everything at this point, right?
I might have some more at the end.
Yeah, that's fine. There was a very specific reason, and it was actually for the benefit of all of you, because, quite frankly, the current policy has a lot of onerous requirements, but I think the revised policy got rid of it. Still, the revised policy, as you have mentioned, has what you guys consider onerous requirements. So I just want to put that I don't think that there can be an allegation that we were trying to delay any of you, specifically when a lot of these applications are not even being filed in accordance with the current policy as adopted. So I just wanted to say that right off the bat. The definition, the definition stuff, I think some stuff is defined within, I guess we could put a section of definitions, but I think, you know, it's pretty clear, but we can certainly look into it if there are any terms other than the ones that you identified that you think, or that they have been identified today. For clarification, I'm happy for you guys to say which ones, and we can certainly try and clarify them a little bit more. We talked about the notice, the mailing of the notice, we talked about that. Tolling agreement. Excellent, raised the issue that it should be modifiable, and I think AT&T raised the issue in terms of the numbers that are already in the tolling agreement. So just as an FYI, the numbers that we put, in theory, most of the time, when what we've been doing, I mean, the reason we put 60 days is even though this commission generally meets every month. As you have seen this year, we have moved around our meetings so that we can accomplish certain things. And also, as time goes by and members may or may not retire, it will be difficult to schedule certain things. And I think the 60-day provides cover. I don't disagree that there could be some change in terms of timing, but what I would suggest if we change this tolling agreement is that 60 days or, and then whatever date, however many days, but it wouldn't be less than 60 days. I think most of the times when you're entering a tolling agreement, based on my experience on this commission, is that nothing is ready for the next month, ever. So a 30-day thing, I think, is just a waste of time.
I'm asking for longer, not for
no, I know, time. I know, no. I mentioned because other people, but what I'm saying is that I would put the 60 days or, and then there would be a space there for you to fill out, but that it couldn't be anything less than 60 days, or do it, X amount of days, no less than 60 days, X amount of days, no less than 75 days. I think that was the intent with the dates that we put there, particularly for that reason and for what Haran mentioned earlier, if there has to be a fiber thing or if something else comes up. I mean, none of this, even regular commission stuff that we continue, it is, 99% of the time, it is never ready for the next month. It is never ready within 30 days. So I think that's what I'm saying with that, but yes, I'm happy to make that redaction to the tolling agreement. I'm not sure what you guys think about that.
That's fine.
No, I agree.
Excellent. The grounds for denial of application, the phrase safety concerns or reliability concerns is impermissibly vague. You're looking for more specificity?
Well, I think you need, yeah. Because it can be impermissibly discriminatory if it's vague. In other words, we don't like that. Yeah, and also, it comes down to possibly trying to design or engineer networks. We've seen places where we don't like that bracket on the pole. Well, can you prove to us any place where that bracket has failed? No, but we just don't like it. I mean, we've hit that sort of stuff, and that's where That's what we're trying to avoid based on our experience elsewhere. We had a city where they didn't want any of our small nodes on poles because a pole fell down, which had a small cell on it, and the engineering study showed it was because of the a museum's banner on the same pole. Because they're telling us, your pole isn't safe, it took down this pole. Your node isn't safe because it took down this pole. We're putting stop on all new nodes of this design. And, well, it turns out three other streetlights went down that didn't have a node. And we ended up redesigning the bracket for that city for the banners. Because the banners were what was, you know, it was a sale that was causing the poles to go over, not our equipment. So things like that are a big concern to us.
Okay.
I think some of the stuff about the more convenient location and whatnot, I mean, I hear all of you in terms of what we can ask and not ask. Doesn't mean I agree with it or council agrees with it, but we'll certainly look into it. But I think a lot of this stuff can be, I think it can be streamlined to the extent of if you have an affidavit from your licensed personnel saying this is the best location, I think that would satisfy that type of requirement, I think. I think it doesn't take away the fact that, you know, for example, our city electrician might say that pole is not sustainable. I do not agree with your licensed professional, and I think pole 27 is better than 45 within the same area. But that's certainly, I read it, I hear it.
And just to give you a real life example,
mm-hmm.
that I believe is about a half mile from here in Somerville. We had a pole, it was approved by the city, and a week later I got an email from a city council member that a bunch of residents have come to him in unison wanting to know why we can't use this pole or this pole that's not as close to their house. So I sent him a letter with the exact reasons, which are both of those poles cannot accommodate a small cell for various reasons. They have too much on them. One had too much on it, and other, something wrong with the other one also. And so, fine, he understood that. 3 months later, the same group of people went to the city engineer, and he called me, not knowing the city council member had already gone to them. So you do have issues where people are trying, and you'll have residents who are trying to say, I don't like that pole too close to my house. There's a pole down the street. And in many cases, it's not even the RF coverage issues. We cannot go, and it's different when we're talking city-owned poles versus wooden utility poles. Wooden utility pole may have too much on it. It may not be tall enough. It may, in one case where the residents were like, go to that one, we would have had to completely rip up the street to install fiber to that pole, because there already was fiber at the other pole. And all those issues come into play as well. And we've looked, you know, we don't pick a pole lightly. It's not like we, you know, throw a dart at a map or anything. You know, there are many engineers who have looked at which pole is which.
I think your next stuff about the FCC license is pretty clear. I do have a question as to the commission is legally prohibited from considering emissions. I'm not quite sure that we are. I think the affidavit is just requesting that you are certifying that you are in compliance with FCC, and I guess I didn't understand.
If that's what the affidavit is requiring, we're fine with that.
Yeah. I mean,
affidavit is going, let me pull it here, is proposed installation complies with the maximum safe distance from the antenna and equipment for prolonged and discrete human or animal exposure under the FCC communication regulations, including but not limited to an attestation, so they're asking for more, of how many feet is considered safe and compliant with federal communication regulations in terms of radiation emission exposure limitations with respect to human and or animal from the proposed antenna for 1 year, 1 month, 1 day, 1 hour. So they're expecting us to re-engineer the FCC's existing reports.
Or copy and paste.
Right, but basically an affidavit stating that this equipment complies with the FCC standards. If it does not, or if any individual does not believe that we do, the entity they should be going to is the FCC.
And I'm not, and I don't think that the policy says otherwise. I think that's why, I think the original one did, which is why then it got switched to putting it together with an affidavit of a licensed, whatever professional deemed necessary. You know, if your suggestion is that it's just, that it basically says that it complies versus that it complies and explain the 700 ways it complies, but I don't know that the commission was ever considering emissions. Okay. It was just considering that you have attested that you are complying with the emissions, which is a very different...
And quite honestly, I'm not sure the one day, one year, all that stuff is in the FCC's order. I just don't know. I have not looked at it.
I'm sure we didn't pull it out of thin air, but we can certainly look at that. Okay. We already talked about need. The setback we talked about. Okay, future development stuff. I guess, based on the way that I read the policy, it's basically saying that if the city's going to develop in an area where there's a small cell, that the city's going to give notice to you guys. I'm not quite sure what your issue is.
Well, several issues. First of all, 60 days notice is not enough in many cases, especially if we have to re-engineer and replace that somewhere nearby.
You mean 60-day notice to remove it and put it, or 60-day notice that it's happening? Because quite frankly, the same way that you guys don't know that you might have a need in 60 days, the city might not know when a plan that was, you know, voted into the budget in 2010 is happening in 2020. It happens.
I'm pretty confident the city would have 180 days notice, 6 months notice, because they have to put out the bids for that. They have to, you know, literally once they decide to go forward, they're putting out the engineering bids, all of that stuff. That's when they should be notifying us that you're going to have to move it. And, you know, it says, and may apply to reinstall. If the application to reinstall is going to be through this commission, which I'm assuming it would be, we're talking once you're, you know, 60 days for this commission to approve it, but you got to keep in mind the engineering time on our part to decide where to move it, find the appropriate location, design the fiber, get the fiber in. In other words, 180 days is even tight to have the replacement up and ready before we have to remove the existing one. That is, you know, that is moving mountains. It can be done, but it's moving a mountain. And that's what we're trying to avoid, is the situation where the city comes to us and says, okay, move this site in 60 days, and it's going to take us another 100 days or 180 days to get the location, the replacement location even approved. We could end up going a year or two without that location.
Okay. I guess I understand.
And that's why I propose the language.
Yeah.
Or such. And I understand. I know of a location right near my house in Downers Grove where they had to move it because they are literally widening the street from 2 lanes to 4 lanes, and they had to move all the utility poles out an additional 25 feet from whatever.
Understood now. Thank you. I'm sorry, you said you're from Historical. Do you mind coming up?
Oh, yeah.
And if you don't mind, if you can tell me your name, since I don't know it.
Eric Hill.
Thanks, Eric. Eric, do you know anything in terms of when this certification that has to be done by Historical and Historical Areas, what's the process for that? Do you know it?
Yeah, so when someone applies for a permit, it gets bumped up to us if the property is within a historic or conservation district. I think our stance is that we would only review poles in a historic district, which we only have two in the city. Harvard Square is a conservation district, so I don't think that we would have any purview on reviewing those polls. So essentially, that review can go concurrently with other city review processes.
But what's that document that you give them? What's the name of it?
Oh, Certificate of Appropriateness.
Thank you. So the Certificate of Appropriateness. So let's say that Company X is applying, and they know that they're going into a historical district.
Mm-hmm.
If they go to you first for a Certificate of Appropriateness,
mm-hmm.
what's your process?
So yeah, so we only review design and appropriateness. So they would apply for CA. We would basically review it, send out abutters notices to all abutting properties, and depending on the review, we could approve it administratively at the staff level or go to a hearing. Typically, everything has an approval or continuance or denial within 5 weeks from when they would submit a CA application. So it's pretty quick. And most of the time, applications are either approved or approved with conditions at that hearing. So that way, the process can move forward. We try not to keep anyone waiting for too long.
And how do you file that online, or do you have?
Yep. So oftentimes, people apply for a permit online, and then if we need more information than what's submitted on the permitting system, we require an application, and then they would just submit all the design details to our office.
Okay. All right. I mean, I think based on that, I think it's appropriate to ask for the Certificate of Appropriateness with the application when it's filed, because otherwise that shot clock is never going to work.
Now,
right.
As I mentioned earlier, I found the exact language in the third report in order.
Yep.
It's paragraph 145. We find, I'll read it out, we also find that mandatory pre-application procedures and requirements do not toll the shot clocks. Industry commenters claim that some localities impose burdensome pre-application requirements before they start the shot clock. And here was almost exactly what you said, Chairman, Madam Chairman. Localities counter that in many instances submit applications that are incomplete in material respects, that pre-application interactions smooth the application process, and that many of their pre-application requirements go to important health and safety matters. We conclude that the ability to toll the shot clock when an application is found incomplete or by mutual agreement by the applicant and the site authority should be adequate to address these concerns. Much like a requirement to file applications one after another, requiring pre-application review would allow for a complete circumvention of the shot clocks by significantly delaying their start date. An application is not ruled upon within a reasonable time period after the request is duly filed. If the state or locality takes the full ordinary review period after having delayed the filing in the first instance due to required pre-application review. Indeed, requiring a pre-application review before an application may be filed is similar to imposing a moratorium, which the Commission has made clear does not stop the shot clocks from running. Therefore, we conclude that if an applicant proffers an application but a state or locality refuses to accept it until a pre-application review has been completed, the shot clock begins to run when the application is proffered. In other words, the request is duly filed at that time, notwithstanding the locality's refusal to accept it.
So I don't disagree that the FCC regulation has tied our hands significantly on a lot of things. I also do not disagree that the FCC regulation is quite impractical in terms of these shot clocks. And I say that with full confidence, not only with regard to sitting on this side of the table, but I find it very impractical for those sitting on that side of the table. Because quite frankly, I think, let's say, I get exactly what you're saying. I understand it completely. It's crystal clear. However, how practical is it for you to file an application that you know will require a certificate of appropriateness, and we will literally have to deny because there is no certificate of appropriateness? I mean, you just heard from historical, it takes them, 5 weeks. Best case scenario, 5 weeks, maybe less, maybe more sometimes. And quite frankly, then we're going to continue entering tolling agreements, or even if we don't deny it, tolling agreement after tolling agreement after tolling agreement. If you already know, as the applicant, that you're going into an area where you need a certificate of appropriateness, why not do that legwork before you file and do it and just go forward? I mean, I'm not seeking for a response, and you don't have to respond, but quite frankly, it's just, I understand, but these shot clocks, I really think that whoever wrote this at the FCC thought that every commission out there was a big bad wolf that didn't want any small cells out there. Small cells are needed. I think we all get it. But at the same time, It is ridiculous to think that some of these things can be accomplished within these shot clocks. That's just my personal opinion.
In your defense, I think what the FCC in writing this was not contemplating or anticipating was that all municipalities were one-stop shopping. They did not anticipate, or do not address in their order at least, entirely separate entities within a municipality.
Or reasonableness, quite frankly.
I mean, I understand. You apply to a city, the city's going to approve it. They don't think, oh, you're applying to the Condo Commission, and it's a separate application to the Historical Commission. It's a separate application for permits. That's what I think they were looking at.
I understand why you raised this issue. I understand the same shot clock time frame. What I'm putting out there is the same thing that I put out there last time when I asked people to hold on filing small cell applications until we finally got a policy that everyone is more comfortable with, which is basically, we're trying to work together here. This is not trying to put up walls. We're not trying to forbid you from doing what you need to do. We're trying to make it reasonable and less cumbersome. And the more, quite frankly, that we work against each other, the more red tape inevitably there will be because of these shot clocks. I mean, the SEC regulation, what has created is more bureaucratic.
That word in English, mumbo jumbo,
cannot be said.
The two-letter abbreviation, Kim.
No, because I'm thinking it in Spanish, and I will not. But I think you all get me. I understand what you're saying. And yes, in theory, this we could do it this way. But then it's just going to create more work for you. Like I don't understand.
So I think that paragraph was perfect. And I think that it's important. I think that it's one thing we could do here is distinguish between the need for a certificate of appropriateness and the node-by-node license agreement that we discussed earlier, and I think both apply. And I think a node-by-node license agreement that we talked about earlier may end up in the... It puts us in a situation that puts us in a potential shot clock violation that is less reasonable than needing a certificate of appropriateness, I think, from historic.
Okay, we already talked about height.
May I, for one second?
Yeah.
I didn't understand the distinction between a conservation district and a historic district. What are the two historic districts that would need a certificate of appropriateness?
So the Fort Washington, which is just a park, that's where an old battery was, kind of in Cambridgeport, so that's really small. You probably won't have any issues with that. The other is Old Cambridge Historic District, which runs along Brattle Street, the Cambridge Common, up to Fallen Street.
So Harvard Square,
not
that's it. One.
It's a conservation district, so it's a little less strict.
And the maps are, there's some maps on your website?
Great. Exactly.
Do we need a certificate of appropriateness in a conservation district?
No, it's our interpretation that you wouldn't.
Great.
I might have to check back in with our director, but I don't think we would want to be involved.
So it's only the two, the Fort Washington and the Brattle Street area, Old Cambridge, which comes from the Common and the side streets.
Correct. Out. And those are administered by the Cambridge Historical Commission. Our conservation districts are administered by neighborhood commissions. So Mid-Cambridge is one of those, as well as Harvard Square and Half Crown Marsh. Half Crown Marsh also abuts the Old Cambridge District. It straddles Longfellow Park. It's a bunch of workers' cottages kind of between Memorial Drive.
Yep, I know exactly where you mean. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that's what it was called.
Really good seafood places.
Let's concentrate.
Oh, sorry.
Let's concentrate.
It's a lot of good ones.
Come on, man. Okay, the color. I think we say to be matched to the best way possible. Are you saying that you can stay there. You don't have to leave. But
oh, okay. I think I'm good.
Okay.
I'm good.
Yeah. I mean, to the greatest extent possible, isn't that... I mean, I see what you're saying.
Enough.
It's not always practicable to match to an 1890 black.
The wording is all installations shall match the existing adjacent streetlights pole colors. Doesn't say practical or anything like that. And what we've actually found, which is kind of funny, we'll go out to a streetlight and the city says, city says, oh, the color code for that is Sherwin-Williams, blah, 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 blah. And the street pole's been out there for 20 years. And guess what? It looks like a sore thumb because, you know, right. Dated Sherwin-Williams 123 versus brand new Sherwin-Williams 123 are two completely different colors.
And I think the difference between a wood pole and a, I think the intent is more or less for the city-owned poles, right. Where you have metal poles, whether painted or not,
now,
they match.
In many cases where we're actually replacing the metal poles,
mm-hmm.
It will match.
It will match.
Okay. I thought it was pretty clear that it's as best as possible, but I'm sure we can clear that up.
Clarify.
Your savings clause is pretty clear. Okay. AT&T. I think we talked about the waivers. I mean, the telling other providers you don't want to clarify anything else on that. I already talked about the tolling agreement. Okay, I did have a question, if you don't mind speaking on it. And I'm sorry, what's your name?
Ed Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Donnelly. And this letter was submitted by Mr. Slade, Jeffrey Slade. I'm not sure if you've seen it. But in number 4, the timing of writing about the denial of the application, he mentioned something about the denial will be in writing and issued contemporaneously with the denial. I'm not quite sure how that's possible if it's based on a commission vote. I mean, is he saying that at that time we actually have to write the denial and provide it to the person? Because I think the way that it's written is actually more favorable to you guys in terms of if you're going to appeal it, because it won't become effective until you actually get the written signed decision versus if you're told orally that it's denied.
We've had a problem in a few denials that we've got in other jurisdictions where we end up getting a denial on a certain date and then mail problems and dating problems cause us to run out of time on an appeal option. And if that's what, that might be what he's getting at possibly, that what, does the date of the vote the relevant date or is the date of the writing the relevant date? I think maybe that could be the issue.
Yeah. That I think is an issue we're trying to address. The act of the denial and the accompanying memorialization of the denial are as synced up as possible.
Yeah, I think our stance on it, and I can certainly get more clarification, and we can certainly clean that up if need be, but our stance is, even though, let's say, today's meeting, we deny your application, our stance is that if we don't provide you the written specific denial until Monday, then Monday is when the denial becomes effective, and that's when your time goes forward. And since we have become green, all of our denials are basically via email. So let's say if we issue it on Monday, you will receive it on Monday. You will be sent it via Monday via email, and that's when the time begins. Not today when we voted. And you didn't get it until Monday. So that has been our stance in terms of these denials, and that's what I believe we were trying to get to in the revised policy, but if that's not clear, that's what we would be clarifying. Yes, Arani.
Yeah, I mean, as Crown said, we actually had I think the longest we've gotten on a denial or anything, or any response from you has been about, I think you're right, Thursday meeting, Monday, so about five calendar days. We have had smaller municipalities that have told us, even though we voted, the official denial won't be until the minutes are approved, and our next meeting is in 31 days. So all of a sudden, okay, do we file with the court for shot clock violation, or do we... I mean, when's our deadline?
And that's why, because
that's
we and because we only meet once a month generally, that's why in the policy we voted, or we're proposing to vote, that it gets issued by me. So that way we don't have to go back to a meeting
right.
to memorialize it, review it, approve it, and then send it out. But again, and I'm happy for us to look at the language and make sure that it's crystal clear, or that in the written decisions that are issued, that it is crystal clear that the denial effective date is the date that I sign, or whoever the chairperson has signs and issues that denial.
One thing that I think would suffice would be adding the written denial will be issued within 5 business days.
Yes, but you're killing me.
I know.
Yep.
You're killing me. I am the chair of 2 commissions, the department head of 1 humongous department that has a lot of things on its plate. I get it.
Right.
And it is our intent.
10 business days.
And it is our intent to
right.
do it as fast as possible.
Right.
When we have companies filing 20 applications every other day, 5 days might be a bit much. But yes, we do strive for excellence and, you know, getting it out there. But yes. So that's what you were getting at? Okay. All right. Okay, the insurance stuff about proof of self-insurance, I don't foresee that an issue, and I will certainly, I think that that should be cleared up in the policy, and I agree that self-insurance should be enough. I mean, but what do I know?
And maybe just going back quickly on the insurance issue, there are ways we can demonstrate that too. If there's something you want to have a back and forth on about how we can demonstrate that, that's in a way that's amenable to the commission, we can certainly work with you on that point too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm assuming that whoever the powers that be that are doing the license agreements, they probably have an idea on how to do that. But I don't know that they were thinking about that. But yes, I think that's totally reasonable. And you know, I'm sure you're not the only self-insured company out there. Okay, AT&T raised the same issue as the emissions, and again, I think we already discussed that. Okay, and then the demonstration of need. I know the other companies talked a little bit about that. I'm not sure if you want to expand on that. No. Okay. Traffic signal poles. I'm not sure I understood the issue there, and I'm not sure what.
At some point in the discussion, I think it was advised that they were not to be included. Not that they could not be, and that maybe some further discussion with council.
Okay. Bless you. Do we know the reason why not to be included? Is it a safety reason in terms of, or an accessible issue, or I'm not quite sure.
No, I don't. I don't know.
Okay. And then AT&T's position is that they must be included.
That would be the meaning of this. Yeah, I think that would be our position. I think the paragraph there that we submitted speaks for itself.
I think there might have been some discussion with vendors that it wouldn't be practical to put them on traffic signals with the amount of equipment and structure that would need to be built to put it on. It might be the cost would be.
It would almost certainly be a replacement pole.
Yeah.
The reality is, from all of our deployments over the course of 10 years, being at the intersection is the best possible deployment. Reduces proliferation significantly because you're getting one pole, one antenna that's going down in 4 directions. Traffic poles are obviously key infrastructure right at the corner. And Cambridge is not the only place that is not inclined to allow use of those, but thinking about how it might work is something that's valuable because it would be a good thing for the city, I think, to allow that deployment.
I think it's also, you promised on the next step, you mentioned costs. You might have to replace the pole. It's our cost.
Okay.
Which, in many cases, depending on the age of the light structure, someone in the engineering department may, like, light bulbs may go off. Oh, good. Yeah. We can use those. We were going to replace that anyways. Use it somewhere else.
Okay. I know aesthetic requirements. We talked already about the 15 feet. AT&T also raised the issue of the spacing requirements, the 150 feet radially. So I'm not sure. Steve, that's in your wheelhouse if you want to ask more questions about that.
I think it had more or less to do with co-location than 150 feet.
Okay.
And not to have to put a site on every pole being a pole roughly between 100 and 150 feet.
Okay.
I think some of our confusion was around the definition around co-location as well there. I think we addressed that in the letter as well.
Okay.
Another point about the 150 feet is that we could run into a problem where if there's something... We don't have any mechanism to know what is about to be built, right? So we know what's there when we pick a pole, when we apply for it. If somebody else has applied for the next pole over midstream, we could end up having two poles next to each other, which would defy the rule. I think it's that 150 feet rule. There's a preference toward co-location that's clear throughout. Having that strict 150 foot rule, we could end up in a compliance problem that we didn't know about, that was nobody's fault.
Another issue with 150 foot pole. A lot of cities, and as was mentioned earlier, being on a corner is better. And you know, you may want to waive the 150 feet rule if you decide to keep it for intersections, because then you can sort of get stuff. There's already the intersections are already, I don't want to say cluttered, but already have stuff up there. So aesthetically, you already have the lights, you already have, you know, street lights. I'm talking about other things at the intersection, and you should want to encourage us to go to the intersections where you're not going to be in front of a building, you're not going to be in front of someone's window, so.
Okay. The height we talked about and preference of equipment and cameras. Okay. So I have gone through what I had in terms of questions as to what was submitted to us, so. You may not see. I just had those questions. I'm all set now. You guys can answer them.
Nothing else you said.
Does anyone want to say anything else in terms of what is out there? Yep.
Can you clarify the 31st?
Okay. So this.
What do you anticipate?
So you said you might want to say something else, Joe. Do you want to say?
Yeah, I have two other thoughts. And
yep.
We obviously captured our big ticket items in our written comments. There were two that we decided not to speak about because we're delighted that we're getting the ball moving, but I'll raise them now because of the kind of more robust conversation that we're having. And the two are, we're obviously here every month, and most of what we've been applying for over the course of the past 18 months are 6409 eligible facilities requests that the commission doesn't have any authority to deny. And I think that what you should do while you're considering how to approve this, get a new policy in place that is preferring co-location, I think you should have a capacity in the new policy to approve 6409 applications administratively.
6409.
That don't have to go through the full, full hearing.
These are the replacement of the shroud with the bigger shroud, but that's within the allowable
within
because
rules.
It's not a material.
Authority you would have to review it under, which is whether it is an eligible facilities request or not, we don't need a public hearing to do that. That's my thought.
And with that raised, so aside from all of this, as you know, the reason why we had asked not for new applications to be submitted is also because we're in the process of also building a small cell specific application that actually makes more sense in terms of what you're doing. It's in the process of being built and hopefully it will be ready and deployed shortly. But I guess my question is, would it also be helpful to have an application that is specific to 6409s, where you already say, this is where we are, this is what, and a much shorter one in terms of...
It's really, and it would be a series of yes or no questions.
Yeah.
Like the current address, and is it this big or this big or this big, and...
Okay.
If all the answers are yes, then stamp it.
Do you see why I can't stay with 5 days all the time?
I was just suggesting.
Okay. What was the other thing?
that a lot of what all of us right now at the table are looking at, we're only talking about 4G right now in this small cell policy. Everybody here is talking about and thinking about and working together on what 5G is going to look like, and the antenna is going to be a little different. And I think that we're within the 12 or 14 month range, I think, where you're going to be hearing about this more and in a more robust application form. I think the policy has to either contemplate what that technology is going to be or what future smart technology is, and have some mechanism to be a little bit more flexible around approvals or around considering new equipment designs.
So how is that different from the 4G? Like,
so right now, everybody has a little bit of a different model. Right now, the city of Boston has approved a 5G design that has a three-panel antenna. So it's a 4G antenna, or if it's co-located 4G and 5G, there's a 4G canister antenna and a three-panel antenna that looks in three different directions, either beneath the luminaire or beneath the antenna.
Oh boy.
Oh yeah, 5G. This is my last meeting.
wouldn't 5G substitutions for 4G qualify as 6409 eligible facilities changes, and therefore you have to be careful?
Not all of them.
Well,
right?
If it's just antennas, or if it's just equipment, or it's antennas and equipment, there you go.
Well, we don't know.
I think there's size limitations on the your.
There are, but they're pretty generous.
Yeah, but what Joe I think is saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that although that could be the case, it could also not be the case for future 5G.
Well, I think you should plan for it, because it's a likely case, or a common case.
And take the 6409 point out of the equation for now, for fun. I'm really thinking about a new 5G deployment that maybe might not be a co-located deployment, that might be on a new pole. And I think the policy could have some sort of a way through which we would make a presentation for a generic new exhibit type of thing, some flexibility around what new technology is going to look like and how this policy is going to encourage that sort of deployment, I think would be a good thing.
Okay.
So you're thinking 12 to 14 months before 5G will be deployed?
I don't know.
It's getting larger rather than smaller.
The 5G antennas will be smaller, right?
They
will be small.
Yeah. It's a different thing, and it also in many cases has an integrated radio, so the antenna may not need a shroud on the side of the box, a shroud on the side of the pole. But it's the technology, and technology changes depending on who you talk to, and there's some variability there.
And it's also chicken and egg in terms of when 5G is going to become ubiquitous. Is a chicken and egg situation. In other words, the carriers don't want to build 5G until there's enough customers to use the 5G, and the cell phone manufacturers don't want to make 5G cell phones until there are enough people who want to buy the 5G cell phones, and there aren't going to be enough people who want to buy the 5G cell phones until there are enough 5G nodes. So, and most of us are stuck in a 2-year contract, so it's at least 2 years before you can even get a 5G phone, if they're available.
Okay.
See, there are the easy ones.
Thank you. How fantastic. Anyone else before I get to Haran's question? Okay.
I do have one question. Do you, in dealing with other communities and jurisdictions, do you have any issues with the safety aspect when one of these poles come down with the proximity to the antenna if it's still energized?
Well, frequently when there's a knockdown, it's de-energized. We had a car hit a streetlight in the city of Boston a couple of months ago for us, and as soon as the car hit it, it kicked a breaker and the thing turned off.
Same with us. And it's also important to note that 99.9% of the poles that go down are unfortunately, I won't say pole drunk, but drivers. And it's no bigger an issue than, they hit a streetlight, having that live electric wire sitting on the ground. Mm-hmm. In many cases, breakers will shut off immediately, including on, you're the one who designs and approves the streetlights. I'm sure they, as soon as one goes down, the breaker shuts it off.
Not necessarily.
The small cell facilities have a disconnect switch in them, so first responders can always trip that if needed.
If it trips. There's always that if, and I'm just wondering if you offer any training or any training to first responders or the electrical departments or other people who are working close proximity to these know enough to shut them down when they're working within that limitation.
The electric companies, they have, it's my understanding, because we don't do the training, but they have trained all of their employees to use that emergency, but there's a big button on the side of them to turn it off when they're going up that pole for any reason.
We have materials, Verizon has materials that we can provide to first responders.
Okay. It would be a one-page handout.
Sure.
So you want the handout?
I would like it included, yeah. I mean, more of first responders. We have our guys, you know, the city owns. As you know, now you're looking to go on the city-owned poles. Now you have a whole another bunch of personnel, not necessarily first responders. They're just electricians, maintenance guys, you know, that work for us, that go up, and they need to know what's going on up there. And especially when it does fall, because if it doesn't go off and the shroud comes off and you have a live antenna there, you're still in close proximity to those, you know, 2 feet, 4 feet, whatever those are. It's just for the safety of everybody.
I haven't seen one in a while, but can someone help me out here? I believe the FCC's mandated sticker says something about the shutoff. I'm not 100% sure on that.
No, it just says who to contact.
Okay, so maybe each company that has whatever you have, if you have something that you can provide the commission, that would be helpful. And then just email it to us, and then I can make sure to distribute throughout the city. Okay, so my intent is to ask the commissioners not to adopt today the proposed revised small cell policy that was attached as Exhibit 1B to the agenda. Because, as I think as we have all mentioned, there are some things here that we think need to be clarified a little bit and that we need to look at and some modifications that we would make. So I would suggest not making any changes today so that we can incorporate and also reach back to legal counsel in terms of any legal substantive issues that were raised today and in the comments that were submitted, so that if there is in fact some stuff that we legally have to change, that we do. And then my proposal would be to ask and encourage no small cell applications to be filed for now. My intent is that we put back, that we incorporate any revisions that we want to make that we talked about today, like the
pole heights and sizes.
The notifications, the certified mail stuff, and you know, anything else that council, once they finish reviewing these things, propose that we provide to the public before the October 31st meeting that we have another revised policy with all these changes incorporated therein. That on October 31st, as part of our agenda, we have the newly revised policy available, and at that point, hopefully, have it all squared away. Hopefully, have the license agreement out and about by then. Make the changes to the tolling agreement so it's a little bit more malleable, and then adopt on the 31st, and then have all the small cell applications heard in our November meeting. So that after October 31st, you have a policy that's finally in a more clear form, and that you comply with that policy versus the policy that we adopted that is currently in place. That would be my suggestion at this point and my recommendation to the companies. But that's what
I agree with that.
I agree.
Madam Chair, could I ask the Commission to provide a red line at that point when you publish the policy?
I will try my best, but like I said, there's a lot of people working on this, and I think from...
I just want to make the request. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I can print them over. This is from
the future.
Yeah. But that's where I'm at, and I think also I will look at... I think we should look at the 6409 stuff. I agree. I think those hearings are pretty...
No, I agree. I agree also.
So we'll definitely raise that with council, and hopefully be able to incorporate that as well. And then maybe have the applications online by then. But yeah, that's where I'm at.
Sounds good to me.
Yep.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very useful. People calling on me?